You own a holdco. I think Gridley Enterprises is the name of it. Within it, you have a bunch of different things. So you will own stuff as funky as like a fireworks company called Alamo Fireworks. You own like a software roll-up called Dura Software. You have like a coffee chain, I think. Is that right? You have like a drive-through coffee chain that's got like three or four locations or something like that. And then you incubate a couple projects. One of which I used actually recently.
Michael, what up, dog? Sean, where are you? You're in Tahoe?
I'm in Lake Tahoe, yeah.
How is it?
It's amazing. Yeah, this place is great.
Is it just a getaway from crypto?
No, it was a Father's Day trip. So, you know, came out here with my wife's family. And yeah, it's been cool. Just been like at the lake, in the pool, all that good stuff.
That's awesome. Who? So you, Sean, you want to introduce this guy?
Yeah. Okay, great. So we got Michael Gridley. Is that the way you say it?
Yep.
Yeah, Michael's here. I've been following you on Twitter for a while. And I think you almost bought our NFT for the 5 minutes of fame, but you got outbid at the last minute. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I had a whole plan about it. I was actually going to short it and then try to make profit from it and sell it in 15-second increments, but some really rich crypto person came in and swooped it out from under me. So right.
Sam loves
sharding. I had a huge plan.
but it worked anyways. You got on the pod anyways without it because you're a pretty interesting dude. I've been following you on Twitter mostly because you tweet about Chili's a lot, and I'm a big Chili's guy, huge Chili's fan. But you kind of fit into this sort of like Andrew Wilkinson bucket, which is like you run a holdco, and you run like a pretty big holdco. And so let's just give people kind of like your rundown. Here's what I know about you. You own a holdco. I think Gridley Enterprises is the name of it. Within it, you have a bunch of different things. So you will own stuff as funky as like a fireworks company called Alamo Fireworks. You own like a software roll-up called Dura Software. You have like a coffee chain, I think. Is that right? You have like a drive-through coffee chain that's got like three or four locations or something like that. And then you incubate a couple projects. One of which I used actually recently called Near, which is like an easy way to hire people in Latin America. And I found this awesome dude. You know, not a plug for Near necessarily, but it did work exactly as intended. I found this awesome operations guy for my e-commerce business there, Nico. So that's what you do. And I don't know, Sam, where do you want to start? We can go into kind of high level, or we could dive into any of the details. Where do you want to start?
He put together this really good document that explains all the different businesses. But to summarize, it looks like it's like 8 or 9 or 10 of them. And so I understand the size. It's over 100 million in revenue, right? And over 750 employees for all 8 or 10 of these.
Yes.
Whenever I hear people be like, okay, yeah, my kind of the accumulation of the businesses that I own, some percentage ownership stake in, is worth over $100 million. Or like a real estate guy will be like, you know, I have a $1 billion real estate portfolio. In my head, and I'm sure there's a bunch of listeners who are like this too, they're like, so what does that mean? Are you super loaded? Is this how do I think about that number, right? Because like, you know, if I get a salary, that's the money I keep. If I run a business and I say top line revenue, that's not the money I get to keep. So when you own 100% of your holdco, and your holdco owns businesses that add up to over 100 million in revenue, does that mean you're just big ball and shot calling? Are you paying yourself like $10 million a year or more out of the profits of these businesses? Or what does that really mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of the way I've set up the structure is like, I wanted to be very flexible in terms of strategy. So there's some stuff in here that's just like compounders, like Dura, for example. Like, we want to be the next Constellation Software someday. So like, that's just compounding. The money I put into that and the effort and time that I put into it, like I don't get cash flow from that stuff. But that's by design. Like, I'm just a long-term player and a long-term person on all this stuff. You know, the things we went through, just kind of the 10 big holdings that I have, those are all things that I have 50, 60, 30, 40% of companies. So it's not like I totally am with you. Like, I felt stressed being like, okay, well, I don't want to be the guy coming in and bullshitting about a bunch of numbers, but also like, I'm from Texas and like I have a hard time like bragging and being like, well, okay, here's what my net worth is and here's how much money I make and all that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to balance it out to where we can actually get there without getting past my comfort zone.
How do we
All right, a quick message from our sponsor, which is, of course, HubSpot. Now, look, growing a business is tough, and it's tough because a lot of times you have to duct tape a ton of software together to make it work. I've been there, and it's a pain in the butt. You have this thing connecting to that thing, and the two things that are being connected, one of them breaks, or the thing connecting them doesn't work, and it's a mess. You have all these moving parts, and it's just a pain in the butt because you don't know where the single source of truth is. And that's where HubSpot's customer platform comes into play. Finally, you've got this single source of truth where everything is organized and tracked in one place. For example, if you have customers emailing you, they've got really easy ways to see who on your team is replying to which customer, what they're saying, and things like that. And you can track it all in one place. They also have a lot of AI-supported stuff, which means that you can automatically know which type of messaging you need to send to that type of customer. And yes, it sounds natural, like a real person. I actually use it. I use it with my company, Hampton, and it works wonderfully. And when leads come in, you know which channel they came through, you know who's going to follow up with them, and it's all seamless and easy. So if you're interested, it's simple. Go to HubSpot.com and check it out and see how you can use it to grow your business.
Let's not balance that out. Let's just go to the other end and make you incredibly uncomfortable. Tell me how your net worth, your checking account number, and what it felt like when you lost your virginity. You can pick one. Go now.
Really drunk, four, and yeah.
Yeah, let's really get into it. And it's like, oh, you don't want to reveal your penis size? That's fine. Just tell me about your net worth then. We'll settle for that.
But in seriousness, there's like a mental model for these businesses, right? Like some businesses, like you call it a compounder, right? It's like if you go into a business like this, you're going to put up, it only takes X dollars to start. And then it takes Y years to kind of get to some good outcome. Like I'll just give you like a venture startup, right? Like I come from the Silicon Valley venture world. Silicon Valley venture world is you put $0 of your own money up, but you're going to raise likely somewhere between $300 million from venture capitalists over time. You shouldn't expect to see any big money until you exit, which is on average 7 to 10 years. And so like that's the profile of that versus my e-commerce business took, I don't know, I put in $600K to start it. That was my first kind of year commitment that I had to put in. But we can take quarterly profits now. You know, a year or two, we could take quarterly profits if we wanted to. We decided to roll that into growth. But we think that by year three or four, we should be seeing pretty healthy, you know, quarterly profits that will pay for a sweet lifestyle, right? So that's like just to paint a picture of what type of business you're getting into. Most people don't know how the holdco business works. So give me those sorts of like, what does it take to start? How long do you have to wait to get a payday? How big are those You know, are you playing a software game like a VC software game? You can make $1 billion. E-commerce, unlikely to happen, but you can pretty safely make tens of millions of dollars if you do it right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think my theory on stuff is it's been incredibly difficult to find good opportunities over the past 5 years. So I've structured stuff that I want to be able to do any opportunity that comes through the door, right? And so like, so the danger is, say, for example, I run across a fun idea to work on that, you know, maybe is in the roll-up space. Well, like that's going to require outside capital, right? Dura required outside capital. My partner and I, who started the business, he's former head of support for Rackspace. He's the CEO of the business now. We put up our own money to do the first acquisition. And then when we ran out of money, right after a couple million dollars, we had to go out and raise money. And so that's playing that kind of VC compounding game that I talked about. You know, other stuff like the coding bootcamp that we start, like that pays me money every month. It's similar to what you're talking about. You know, the thing I like about those kind of cash flowy LLCs and stuff like that is like, you know, the upside isn't as good. Like you can't have $1 billion exit in that stuff 20 years from now, but you could start cash flowing really quickly. So I like to have a blend of all those things because you can't live on appreciation.
How much profit does the 100 million make? Or I think you said over 100 million, but let's just say it's 100 million. How much profit does it actually make? And let's say that you own 30% of one company that makes 10 million in profit. Do you say like, all right, we're going to take of that 10 million, we're going to take out 3 million in profit. We own 30%. We get 1 million.
Yeah. Well, typically the stuff in a portfolio for small businesses like this is going to end up run 15 to 20%, you know, EBITDA margins. So then you do a calculus and say, okay, well, based on that, like free cash flow potential margins, like, okay, you got to pay off debt service and all that kind of stuff if you have it. And then is it better for you to take the money out or should you reinvest it inside the business? And by and large, most of these things are reinvesting because I don't have better places to put the money than reinvesting in assets and new acquisitions and all that kind of stuff.
Which business is the best cash cow? Is it like, you know, the fireworks company where it's like, well, open like 3 months a year and it just prints it prints profits for 3 months and then we like don't have to think about it for the other nine? Like, I don't know if that's true. I'm just saying that out loud.
Which business is the best one and why is it fireworks?
Dude, fireworks, here's why I love fireworks. It was the first business that started my whole platform and I was the CEO of it, and it is the hardest business in the world to run. Like, the cash flow sucks. Like, we aren't even open yet for 4th of July. We open in 2 more days. And we've been spending money to get ready for it all the way through since January the 2nd. And you have to predict what's going to happen 6 to 12 months ahead of time. And then you have to put up all the cash for it, buy all the fireworks, get all the locations out of. We have 200 locations across the state of Texas. Wow. And then open them all up. And then we really don't break even until about 7 or 8 p.m. on the night of the 4th of July. So it is, when I ran that business, that was where I cut my teeth as a CEO. Like, it was the hardest business to run, to where I went to these other businesses and people would like pay you before you delivered the service. Or like when we started the coding bootcamp was the second business. And I was like, you mean they pay us before we teach them the classes? Like, this is amazing. I thought it was the greatest thing ever. So every other business feels like
how much revenue does a fire one do? Fireworks?
It's multiple tens of millions. Yeah.
No shit. That makes, let's say, $20-$40 million selling fireworks for 2 weeks?
We do it twice a year, for the 4th of July, and then we do it again for New Year's. In Texas, it's warm enough that actually New Year's is more pleasant than any place else.
Golly, that's amazing. And that's quite profitable if you do well for the like the remaining like 3 hours. In that 3 hours, you make all your profit.
All your profit, because everybody shows up at the last minute. That's the other part I didn't tell you. Yeah, nobody buys anything until the last day because consumers have this habit of not doing things ahead of time.
So that business is actually kind of an ugly business then, because it's like you have to predict things. And I don't know, the world is very unpredictable the last few years. So you have to predict demand. You have to operate really well in a very tight time crunch. Like, all your demand gets squeezed into this tiny pipe. You're putting up all the cash up front. So you're taking some risk there. You're a clever guy. Did you come up with any clever operating hacks to like make that business suck less that other firework people don't really do?
Yes, we have a bunch of those. I didn't come up with any of them. The thing I realized, and this was about 14, 15 years ago, I actually really suck at optimizations. Like, I want to live at like 80,000 feet with like big ideas and strategy and doing what we're doing right here, right? Like, I want to live in an idea space. And what I realized about 6 years into running that business was I am precisely the wrong person to run this business. Because what you're talking about is this like game of inches where you have to be like optimizing stuff all the time. And like, I find that incredibly boring. Like, that is the most, like, that and accounting and HR are like the three most boring things you'd ask me to do in my life. And what we've done is a ton of those kind of optimizations. Like, that business has exploded in the past 5 years, no pun intended, through just getting the right people on the field. And it means me not doing it because I absolutely am the wrong person to run that business. But we do a bunch of different stuff. Like, we brought digital point of sale to that business. It used to be handwritten for a long number of years. So some pretty basic stuff that you're like, really, it took that long? But yeah, we've done all that kind of stuff. But it's the royal we. It's not me.
How much money did you said you started this thing with $2 million of you and your partner's money. And then is the rest like a fund that you raised?
So Dura was something we started with our own money. The fireworks business, I got that the old fashioned way. It's a family business. I inherited it. So that's why you're like, how'd this guy end up with the fireworks business? I was told I have a fireworks business now, and it's great.
What about the other things? Did you have to raise? So it's like, is each one like its own? You raise money for each one if you need to raise money, or you just use your own money?
Yep. Just if I need to syndicate the deal, I syndicate the deal with other people. You know, what I've learned, and I only do, is I hate raising money for stuff unless I'm putting my own money in it. So I'll put a substantial amount of my net worth in new stuff. And then when I go out to raise money, I feel like not yucky. Otherwise, I feel yucky. But yeah.
And which of the business? Okay, so we thought maybe the fireworks business is the best one. It turns out that's kind of a pretty gnarly business. Which of your businesses would you say is like the most in the cash flow category? Like, it's just so beautiful because it works. It just worked right away. Didn't take a ton of money. It's profitable. It's not like this brutal business to operate. Which one do you like the best?
Yeah. The coding bootcamp is the best one. It's all services, low CapEx. The thing I like the most about it, it actually helps people, it changes their lives. And that's not bullshit, by the way. You'll notice a theme, and all this stuff, I really enjoy helping people. And it's a life transformation thing when people go through that and get a better job.
Clearly you've never had a bottle rocket fight, man. Cause those are pretty amazing too. How big is the,
please don't do that.
Please don't do
that. That is low eight figures.
That's amazing.
And very profitable.
That runs kind of consistent with what we were talking about, that 15 to 20% EBITDA margins.
And so you got a bunch of these. So I like your Twitter because you talk about a bunch of things that I think most people aren't talking about. My feed is very I don't know. My Twitter feed is just the same crypto people, the same Silicon Valley people. And then there's five people that are different. And I think you're friends with all of them. That guy Molson, I think, is a total nut. I find his feed to be hilarious. You're kind of a nut. You're hilarious. There's this guy, Jay Vasa, blah, 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 blah. I don't know how to say his last name exactly. Long Indian last name. He's super smart. Yeah. And people just don't follow you guys in the same, to the same level as I think you should. I'll make a list of these people. I'll tweet it out because I think you guys are all way more entertaining on Twitter than most. But I want to read you a couple of tweets and I want you to just kind of riff on, kind of explain it, but riff on what you mean there, what was the kind of the golden thing there. So, you had one about going to touristy places, but doing non-touristy things. You were tweeting out, you were in China and you're tweeting out, what a paper recycling mill. What is waste paper from the US? Where does it go once we where does the waste paper go? And you found where it goes in China. And it was this gnarly factory. And so I don't know if you could talk about that or just this idea of going on vacation or going to a touristy place, but then hitting the non-touristy parts of that country. Talk a little about that.
Yeah. Well, that was a business trip. I was there training the team and helping them go learn how to buy fireworks. We were just driving down the road. And literally, so the process of going to buy fireworks is there is a Silicon Valley of fireworks, and it's in China. And it's about a 2-hour flight from Hong Kong in the southeast of China. And you go to this place, and it's the same thing every day. You go, the Chinese take you to a fancy dinner, and there's always the same restaurant, the same food. And then they take you to a factory, and then they shoot you some fireworks, and hopefully you buy them. And that happens for 6 days in a row. And
you have to drink a bunch of nasty Biju, right?
They have Budweiser, Chinese Budweiser. They serve you, and it's pretty fun.
Qingda, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. But yeah, after the fourth year of doing that, I was there with the team, and we were driving along, and I was just so sick of going to yet another fireworks factory because they all look the same. It's just the same little old ladies doing the same thing. And all the fireworks workers, by the way, are 70 years old. They can't hire young people to work in fireworks factories. It's just crazy. And I was what is that over there? And they're oh, that's the box factory. And I was a box factory? Let's go over there. And so they pull over to the side of the road. The driver goes in and the Chinese seller to us takes us in for a tour of this box factory. And for me, it was just an opportunity to kind of push a little bit and really get underneath and understand how a culture lives and really functions. And he told us look, they're having a problem making boxes now because they can't put the wastewater directly in the river anymore. I was oh, this is why things are so cheap in China. But yeah, that's it. You just kind of start wandering and then magic happens. So that was one of those moments.
What type of trip was that where you bring a bunch of Texas firework workers to China? And I just imagine what the fuck is this soy sauce shit? You know what I mean? Just imagine that conversation. And you must have had a blast hanging out with a bunch of Texas firework guys and a bunch of Chinese fireworks guys. You guys, that we really got brought together there on that one. our love of blown shit up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm somewhat worldly. The guy that we took on the trip, actually the COO for the business, is a former senior military officer who is Romanian and lives here in San Antonio now, used to work for Aldi, and they didn't know what to make of him. They were just totally confused why we had a Romanian with us, going through rural China. So it was pretty good times.
Have you had any of these other, have you intentionally gone and sort of gone off the beaten path to Because I feel like what you're, when I look at your Twitter feed, you've sort of accumulated a bunch of random disparate business knowledge. And a lot of this comes from like, oh, you see a guy selling something on the street. You're like, hey, so what is this? Where does this come from? How do you do this? Right. Yeah. That sort of thing. Can you tell any other stories of, you know, sort of like intentionally stumbling into interesting things? Because I think more people should do that. I want to kind of like, you know, hear some of those stories.
It's a really good question. I need to think of a good answer. I'm glad this is being edited. When have I done that the most? We went down one time. We went down. This is super interesting. You know, our business Dura has some employees in Medellin in Colombia. You know, where Pablo Escobar is from. So we went down there to just kind of like start wandering around and like meet our employees and like understand, should we outsource more here? And we just started like going around with a guide and just like asking people questions like, what do you think of Americans? What is it like here? And like, you just start to see random stuff. I mean, the reason I started the coffee business, by the way, is like I was riding my bike around Arkansas and I'm like just riding outside the Walmart headquarters because like I'm a business nerd and staring at the Walmart headquarters. And like there's this like drive-through coffee shop there and it was COVID and I was bored. And so I just sat there for an hour and these guys were just printing money. And I came home and I called my buddy who I'd wanted to work with for years. And I was just like, hey, we should start a coffee business. And he said, why? And I sent him the pictures. I was like, look at all these people. They're just like printing money. So it's just kind of this idea of just like, for me, like the way I build ventures and the way I find them is just kind of by like stumbling around like an idiot. And then like you end up in front of the Walmart headquarters and watch some guy selling millions of dollars worth of coffee. So yeah, that's another story.
And you went to the Berkshire Hathaway like summit, which I think is kind of like a pilgrimage for like business people / entrepreneurs. It's like, you got to go visit the Mecca. And like you see the old kind of religious, you know, leader, you know, the 90-year-old guru sitting there. And is it worth it? Should I go?
You definitely got to go at least once. I mean, it was like, so I'm 47. So like I always regretted I didn't see Jerry Garcia before he died. And like that was the way I felt about seeing Charlie and Warren. And you know, it's like one of those things where I was kind of happy to be there because it felt like a once in a lifetime thing. And the people watching is amazing. Like it's like, it's like the combination of like cash, like investing and like a NASCAR race. Like it's perfect. So just had so much fun doing it. But it's also kind of, you know, I feel like going at this point, like Charlie and Warren are getting up there. Like they're 92 and 98. Like the morning, you know, Warren spent a lot of time just kind of trying to find his words. And then he got into a rhythm and it was like he was his old self again. And it was pretty awesome. But I mean, I think if you're a capitalist, you got to go once. You just got to go once because you're just like, It's just such an insane experience seeing these people so devoted to the company, dropping $250 on a pair of Roper boots or Justin boots, and then walking over and drooling over like how they can buy like a Sunbeam boat. Like it's just like just the coolest thing. So you got to go at least once.
Sam, have you been?
No, I was invited to go. I think you and I were invited with Sieva and Suli, and I didn't go. I guess I would go just to see it. Dude, those guys are old. Aren't they like, isn't Charlie Munger like 93?
98.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I guess next year would have to be like the last one, maybe.
You got to go just to watch him and see how much peanut brittle he eats in a 4-hour setting. Like, it was unreal. The guy ate like 4 pounds of peanut brittle. And when I like live tweeted the thing, like it was like, I can't believe he's still eating this much peanut brittle. I'm 47. There's no way I could do that. He was just sitting there pounding it the whole time.
Dude, that peanut brittle from C's is fire. I feel that. It is pretty amazing.
These guys have like, they have the most success and they do the opposite of what every like, you know, success coach and like motivational entrepreneur does, you know, tells you to do. It's like, you know, they're like, you know, it's like if you go on Instagram, it's like, oh, I need to, you know, wake up at 5 a.m. I need to, you know, meditate. I need to do my ice plunge. Then I need to do my CrossFit workout. Then I need to like, you know, do my daily gratitude journal. Then I need to do my like hyper-focus chamber where I go and I figure out my priorities for the day. Then I need to like speed read and listen to my podcast on 2x speed. And these guys are basically like, you know, they somehow made it. They became the richest people in the world, lived until they're, you know, until they're about 100 years old. And they wake up every day, they eat McDonald's breakfast, eat a bunch of M&Ms and Diet Cokes. And then they read and play bridge all day and like go for walks. And, you know, that's where they get their ideas from. And so, you know, I think there's something to what they're doing. I think it's a, You know, I think they're still alive because they're low stress despite what they eat. And I think they're smart thinkers because they don't overload their brain with information like I'm guilty of. And I think a bunch of people are when you're hooked into social media, you're just constantly consuming info.
This data is wrong every freaking time.
Have you heard of HubSpot? HubSpot is a CRM platform where everything is fully integrated.
Whoa, I can see the client's whole history. Calls, support tickets, emails, and here's a task from 3 days ago I totally missed.
HubSpot, grow better.
What of the things in your portfolio, which company besides the boot camp are you like, this is just the greatest thing ever? I'm so happy we own this. More people should know how easy, or not easy, but how straightforward this business is on. It feels like I'm winning in easy mode.
Yeah. Well, I think the Near business, so it's hirewithnear.com. This is the apex of what I want for Girdly existence to be, which is I've gone from starting businesses myself and working in them, then starting businesses and having other people work in them. And this is one that has started basically with me doing no work, but I have substantial amount on the cap table. Like, it's the apex of Girdly automation. Like, I'm always scaling stuff. So the Near business, like, we looked up and I'm in a CEO peer group, and like none of my peers could like hire people. Like, it was the past couple of years, it was just such a mess. And then I'd ask them, well, have you considered hiring overseas? And they're like, I don't know how to do that. How would I do that? So I took one of my associates and I said, hey, we should go build in this direction. There's this huge wave and here's this problem. Let's go try some stuff and see what happens. And that business I like so much just because everything seems like it's on easy mode because everybody's offshoring. Like, everybody wants to do this. It was that way when the economy was going well. Now it's even more so when the economy's going poorly. And I've hired personally of my associates. I have 3 of the 6 that work overseas. I've never met them in person. It's like the best.
And you partnered with someone to make this, according to the About page, right?
Yeah. So Hayden started as an associate of mine. So I hire these people, I call them associates, and it's basically an entrepreneur in training program. So I like mentor them through, I pay them a salary, and then I help them like get out of the like 12 bad ideas that every entrepreneur has to get when they're 27 years old. I help them like think through all those, and then we work on a good idea together. And then at the end of it, they can either start a company with me or they can go take a job or whatever. And so Hayden and Franco were 2 of the guys in that program. And like, I'm on the cap table with them. Like, I put up the money and have been guiding them through it, but they've done all the work.
When you're hiring CEOs, how much equity do you give them, and how much do you pay them, and how do you incentivize them to want to stay with you for a long time?
Yeah, so totally depends upon the situation. You know, obviously, if a business is much more established or demands somebody who's like much more like mature, that makes a situation where oftentimes you have to come up with more. My best situations are when I can partner with somebody. So all this stuff I'm in, while I have significant stakes in it, I have other people on the cap tables. Like, that's one of my, like, I feel like superpowers. Like, I can just like maintain partnerships. Like, I have 100% success rate on partnerships with people. So the absolute best way is if I can get somebody like Paul at Dura is to be like a co-founder. And the absolute best way of that is if they're a co-founder and they put money in it like me, and then they make that their job. Like, that's the absolute best skin in the game kind of outcome. But, you know, you can have anywhere from a 27-year-old who will make 60 to 80K a year plus benefits, to some of these people who are much more senior, like our coffee person. You know, he worked at 25 years at Circle K, and he's running that business. He obviously needs to make much more money than that. And then the equity really depends. Totally depends on the opportunity. It depends on how much skin in the game they want to have, what level of commitment they have, and how early they're coming in the venture. But it could be anywhere from 40% to 20% to 5%.
And why does, let's say for Dura, why does your partner want to give you let's pretend you have 30%. I don't know what you have. Maybe it's 50. Maybe it's a little less. Let's just say 30%. Why does he want to give you 30%? And he's day to day in it, but you're not. Right. So how do you think about that, like value exchange, when you're not going to be the operating person and then they are?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so you're asking that question from the same lens I have, which is like, being an operator isn't our dream. most people, their dream is to be an operator. They're excited when we're able to work together and create an opportunity for them to be their best self, right? And that's what I see kind of as that benefit. And so, and so I think a situation like that where, like, you know, oftentimes I'm part of the very early figuring out what the idea is going to be. I'm putting up a substantial amount of money. I put up more money than say the other partners did. We did some debt to do the first deal. Like, I personally guaranteed it. And then the last thing is, like great teams, they have these complimentary things. Like,
how much money would you use to fund a new business?
So that one was like a couple million. And then some of these are like 50 to 100.
Wow. Okay.
So that's about,
you do put up a lot of money.
Yeah. So, yeah, skin in the game matters. Then that also helps me not to try to do too many things. Like, I could just be like, okay, like, I'm putting real money in this. I better really believe in it. But like the last thing with these operators is a lot of the things I feel like I bring to the business, where it's like strategy, insights, like best practices and connections, like those are things that they're happy to have somebody along on the journey with them who has the same level of commitment and wants to be a board member. Like, I don't want their job. And I wouldn't be good at it. So, you know, I think that's the partnership I end up having with these folks.
Sean, have you heard of this guy named Kevin Ryan?
Only through you. He's like a media, right? Is that the same guy?
Yeah. So, Michael, have you heard of this guy? Kevin Ryan.
I'm Googling him.
All right. So I think there's probably a billion Kevin Ryan. So, like, maybe a baseball, that's a baseball player.
Oh, he's
name,
the Alicorp
like,
guy.
That might come up. So, yeah. So listen to this guy. So early in his career, he worked like in the newspaper business, nothing particularly exciting. And then he worked at this company called DoubleClick, and he was like the 30th employee there, and then took over as CEO. And then DoubleClick was sold for like a billion or many billion. And it eventually became AdSense for Google. So, like, pretty big thing. He told me that he had made like very low digit eight figures. He was like, it was enough money that like I'm set, but like I still wanted to like create stuff. And so him and this guy named Dwight, who I think he worked with at DoubleClick, they started Alicorp. And their whole thing was, we're going to fund companies with $200,000 to $300,000. And all of the ideas are going to come from us. All the ideas are only going to be back of the envelope math. And we're going to hire someone to get it off the ground. And we're going to give it $300,000 and 6 months to prove if this is a good idea or a bad idea. And we're going to do it a bunch of times. A few of their successes that they've done this with are MongoDB, which I don't know what it's at now, but in the range of like a $20 to $50 billion market cap publicly traded software business. The second one is Business Insider, which sold for $600 million, I think, but it's like a big company now. The third one is Gilt Group, which was a clothing company that was huge. It didn't actually work out, but it was huge for a little while. And I think the fourth one, the fourth one is Zola. You guys know Zola? It's like where you go for wedding registries. I believe that's a unicorn. And there might actually be two or three more of these companies that Alicorp has like founded. And basically he was like, yeah, so me and Dwight just sit around and we come up with like a cool idea. Like, I go to a wedding and I just ask people where they bought all the gifts. And like, he's like, I just had this idea. So I knew someone who worked at Gilt Group who mentioned she liked this type of business. I hollered at her. I go, hey, here's $300K if you can get this going. And you get a small portion, but we get most of it. You want to try it? And that's how it worked. He's pretty amazing.
Speechless.
That's impressive. It's like, yeah. I was like, yeah, those guys are really good. Yeah,
this like Holdco model is like in vogue, right? Because it's sort of like, to me, I worked at a startup studio for a while. I think that was like the thing for a period of time, probably still is a thing where you build one company, you run it for a while, you sell it. Great. Now you got cash. You still want to do more entrepreneurial things. And so you self-fund a studio where you're like, we're going to work on a bunch of ideas. And then you try to find like new winners out of those bunches of ideas. And so, like, you know, I worked out of one. That's how I got into tech. You know, Mark Pincus, the guy who created Zynga, then he created one. The guy who created Uber, he created one. Kevin Rose created one. Like, it's just a bunch of serial entrepreneurs who create these. And they've actually had a pretty poor track record of success. And then we see that, like, the Holdco mafia is sort of the same, where you get, you know, guys like Andrew Wilkinson, who's got Tiny. And then you have, you know, a bunch of other people who are doing their own Holdco versions of that, whether they buy boring businesses, they buy sweaty businesses, they buy software businesses, they buy whatever. And you're kind of in that boat. You're in that boat too. What do you think is the I guess, like, how do you think about that, you know, in terms of like, who do you think should be the type of person who should do this? And what are some of the misconceptions or like traps that people fall into when they go down this path? Because I'm sure you've seen a bunch.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's two bad things going on with holdcos right now. I think there's a whole group of people that are doing them and they actually think it's not that much work. I talked to them and I'm like, so why are you doing this? They're like, it seems really easy. I'm like, this is really hard. And the reason number two that it's like super hard is because this is exactly the opposite of operations. Like everything that you do and all the habits and skills that you learn when you are a CEO running a business, which is where most of these people are coming from, or you're a senior exec in a company, like everything you do in a holdco is exactly the opposite. Like when there's a problem, you don't rush in and fix it for your company. You actually say, man, that really sucks. What are you going to do about that? Two entirely different things in terms of the way you approach it. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens with all these people who think holdcos are really hot. As I talk to most of them, I don't think as many of them are wired to be holdco people as they really think they are. Like the Mies, the Xavier Helgensons, like we're odd. Like we're different people. And there's a reason for that, that we're not operators. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens with some of these people.
What's so hard about it?
You know, I think it goes against people's nature, right? So like take me, for example. Like I love to live in this idea space, right? And I have like a relatively crappy memory, which is like why I have to write stuff down like crazy. But that's different for other people. Like a lot of the people that I partner with as operators, they look at like what I do as insanity, because they just couldn't imagine letting go of the vine of these particular things going on. And so, you know, it goes against this human nature where a lot of times, like, for example, those people, like there's this problem going on in the business, they want to sprint to that problem, right? And they can't imagine even stepping away from it. So it just goes against, in my opinion, who you are as a person, and makes it almost incredibly difficult or impossible for some of these people.
Yeah, you say that, but at the same time, I'm like, oh, everybody I know is like, oh, I like to operate at a high level, you know, the 10,000 foot view, and I'm an ideas guy. I don't know anyone that doesn't think they're an ideas guy. Maybe yeah. I just run in the wrong circles, but, you know, I don't know a lot of people who are like, you know what, I like to grind the operator, likes to go grind the day-to-day optimizations versus I like to be the idea guy who helps just get it started and somebody else goes and does all the hard work. You know, that seems like there's a ratio of 100 idea guys to every one guy who's just truly loves executing.
You ever heard of Excel, dog? That's my jam.
I lived in the Silicon Valley bubble too. Like I fit right in. I was great there. And then I came back here to the hinterlands of San Antonio. And like, I started to see these people, and like, I've got buddies who, for example, are senior executives at the largest private grocery chain in America, HEB. Have you guys heard of this company?
Yeah, I love HEB. It's like my favorite grocery store.
It's insane. You should see how optimized those guys are when they're running at 3 or 4% EBITDA margins. And like, they think it's great.
Tell me everything.
About HEB?
Yeah.
What do you want to know?
Like what makes it so great?
It all comes down to the philosophy of the family that owns it. So you have Charles Butt, who is the majority owner, and then his relatives are the other rest of the owners, and then they have a percentage that's owned by the employees. But it's like 85-90% owned by these guys. And so they'll just do crazy stuff. Like when they heard that Trader Joe's was coming to San Antonio, so HEB is located here, there's an anecdote that they just packed up all the senior executives who were in charge of product selection, location selection, interior, store experience, all that stuff. They put them on a private jet and they flew out to California and said, don't come back until you have the best of every single one of their products, because we need to up our game. There's another anecdote when Walmart came to San Antonio that HEB went and lowered their profit targets, because they're just like, we're not losing to Walmart. That's just the way it's going to work. And that all emanated from the ownership, right? You didn't have this like public stock people coming in and saying like, oh, like think quarter by quarter. No, you had these folks that were thinking like, we've been here for 70 years. How are we going to be here for another 70 years and just go crush it? And that goes all the way down the culture. My buddy works there and he said it took 10 years before people stopped referring to him as the new guy. People just stay. Yeah, imagine that in Silicon Valley.
Of all the, it sounds like to you that like HEB is almost like a dream business, or not a dream business, but it's one that like you look at and you're like, damn, that is cool. That is well run. I admire a few things about that. what other companies do you admire that most people don't maybe know about or think about when it's like, oh, that's actually really neat for these following reasons?
Really good question. What other businesses are super sexy? I feel like I've talked a
not
lot
sexy,
about those on Twitter.
But it's just like things where it's like, man, these guys got it made. It's hard work, but it seems like it's like a pretty fun. And I think that what they're doing has a lot of soul and they're doing it right.
Sam, do you have one while he's thinking?
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like it's a lot of Family Guy stuff. I would say, do you guys know Black Rifle Coffee?
I've heard of them, but yeah. I don't know much about them.
I don't drink. So I don't really drink too much of it. I drink the black stuff because the other stuff has a lot of sugar. They're typically drank by like conservatives. Like they advertise on Fox. They've done like a good job of it, this is made in America. It's all about freedom, like that whole thing, which is, well, you know, whatever. That's cool. But they're like, yeah, let's sponsor dirt rally race cars. And I asked them, I was like, why? And they're like, because it's freaking awesome. And like, what's the point of like having this company if we can't do dope shit, like, you know, go to a rally car and give out our coffee? And or they'll do it with like mountain biking races, or they'll do it with they make all this cool content where they're just like doing like the redneck version of Red Bull stunts, right? You know, like and I think that's awesome. I love that stuff. I think that, to me, I imagine in their heads they're like, yeah, they're like, we kind of care about coffee, but we really just care about living a really cool, amazing life and letting people have fun. And it just so happens we're selling a bunch of coffee that allows us to do that. So that's a good example of a business that I like. And they took it public and it's worth like $600 or $700 million. So it's like really successful.
Yeah, they're located here in San Antonio. Have you seen, it's super cool that business, you would think it's like a coffee chain and it's actually just a lifestyle brand. It's all like, you go into the stores and there's like a little coffee thing on the side, and then it's like all t-shirts and swag, and it's good looking stuff. Like, I'm not like their demographic obviously, but like, it's super fun to like go in there and be like, man, these guys, like, I'd wear that even though it doesn't represent me.
I like them a lot. Sean, do you have one?
You know, I do have a couple. I kind of admire like, oh shit, that's simple. I like when it's really simple and the person has like good life perspective. So the guy came on the podcast, Mike Brown. I met him through you. I went to the Hustle office and he was just sitting there hanging out with you. And you were like, this guy's great. You know what's great about this guy? And I think, Sam, you probably know the story a little better than I do, but like, what they did was they would go around to families in Texas that were like, basically living on a gold mine, right? It's like they were living on some valuable deposit of, you know, minerals or oil or whatever. And they would go knock on doors and they would say, hey, you know, you're living on this land. We'll pay you for the land rights in some way. And they would go of those assets. And then they would never go do the oil mining or oil drilling themselves. They would then flip that to the oil company and say, hey, look, we got the title rights, you know, clear and easy that are in the earth. And they were making a killing. So they were making, you know, I don't know, almost $100 million doing this. Is that right, Sam?
Yeah, I believe it was multiple eight figures in profit a year with like a team of like eight people. And they're like, yeah, so.
It was super profitable, super small, super simple. It was like, well, basically we go knock on doors, we call people and we explain what we're doing. And then we make them an offer that they can't refuse. Like, you know, they're not going to do anything sitting on that land. And so, you know, it, to me, I'm like, this is so simple. You compete with pretty much nobody. And then he was like, I was like, so it looks like your brother's working the business. Like, how's that working with family? You know, some people say different things about that. And he was like, no, it's awesome. He's like, I love my brothers. He's like, you know, he's like, my philosophy is you find the people that you love and you do life with them. And he said that, and it kind of changed the way I operated. I was like, oh yeah, who are the people I want to do life with? And like, you know, just kind of pick the five people who are the most awesome and then find excuses to do life with them. That sounded really simple. It's like, oh, I love Sam. I'm going to do a podcast with Sam. And it's like, oh, our buddy Ramon's awesome. Cool. I'm going to go on vacation with Ramon. Or, you know, like you want, and like, you know, hey, this person's awesome. Why don't you come work in one of my businesses, right? Rather than just go work in your own job. So I really liked, I kind of admired that philosophy, and I admired just the like sheer profits of what they were doing and how simple it was and how it didn't require, you know, genius or like, honestly, I'm sure he felt like he was working hard, but it's not that hard. Like, it's not.
Well, he used to say, he was like, everyone we hire, we make them get into cycling because we like going bike riding for 2 hours in the middle of the day. He's like, we all want to go work out. Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of admire people who are the anti hard work crowd, because I'm more of that, like, you know, can you work smarter, not harder? And then can you even like not feel like you're working? Can you turn it into play by, you know, having people who are awesome, you know, doing it with you? So I like that example. The other one is Bill Simmons, who started The Ringer. Like, I really don't think media companies are a very good business. And, you know, ironically, just started a media company. But like, Bill Simmons is fucking awesome. And he kind of changed the game for what he does. Like, every sports journalist did things one way. He just did it differently and built his following sort of unapologetically. And
what did he do differently?
So he just, like, he wrote from the perspective of a fan. And that's actually giving it too much intellectual credit. Actually, what he did was, he was like, all right, what are the rules if you're a journalist? It's like, you need to be objective. He's like, how can I be objective? Dude, I follow sports because I love the Boston Red Sox. I love the Celtics. I'm from Boston. I grew up, my dad used to take me to the games. He's like, I'm going to write as like this diehard fan. And when my team wins, I'm going to be so happy. When my team loses, the sky is falling. He's like, and that, of course, was super relatable to a reader, because that's who your reader is. It's like a diehard sports fan. So he like didn't pretend to be objective. That was like the first part. Then he would be like, cool, I'm also not just like this flat thing that like I can only like talk about sports. So he's like, oh, you know, I love the Die Hard trilogy. So he'll write a column that's like, you know, if NBA players were characters in Die Hard, here's who would be Bruce Willis in Die Hard 2. And like, you know, he would do these crossovers that nobody else really took those risks. It sounded crazy. Like, Sam, you know, you and me both watched MTV's The Challenge. He's like a huge Challenge fan, and he'll talk about it. He'll do a separate podcast about it, even though the audience is kind of niche. But it's so niche that when it hits in a very big way. Like, it has a high like emotional score when he does talk about something that you're in on the joke, like the trade value.
So he's one of your heroes,
or the mailbag,
or one of your business heroes.
And anyways, then he spun off. He was doing podcasting before it was popular, before it was like an obvious thing. And so when he recently sold the whole company to Spotify for like 200 something million, but you know, that I kind of admired that, because it was like, he deserves that. He was podcasting before podcasting was a thing. And so, yeah, he now has the number one sports podcast and he can cash out. And all along the way, there was never really any plan you could draw up how that podcast was going to make the guy $200 million someday. It was like, that was an unfathomable thing, but he did it because again, it's kind of like your Black Rifle example. It's like, yeah, I'm just going to do it because I think it's fun and it's cool shit. And like, I kind of believe in this philosophy that if you take a bunch of cool shit, you put it in the hat, you kind of mix up the hat, like something really good comes of that. And you don't have to be able to draw it out, you know, ahead of time. So I tend to love examples like that, because I want to live my life more like that, where I just do things without so much of a mind map of exactly how it's all going to pay off.
Dude, I love that. I think I saw this amazing quote. I'm trying to find it, but it was from Kanye. And he was like saying, I despise people who do things. I can't find the exact quote, but he's like, I despise people who do stuff and they don't want it to be dope. He's like, if I'm going to do a clothing company, I'm making it dope. Even if that means I lose money, I'm making it dope. I'm making it awesome. But he kept using the word dope. And he's like, I'm just going to do stuff because it's amazing. And yeah, it'll probably make money. But for all the people out there who just do stuff just to get the money, but they don't want to make it awesome in the process, I think that's really weak and not cool and not dope.
Have you heard that Dave Chappelle story he tells on like some late night show about Kanye?
Yeah, tell it.
My life is
dope.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't remember the exact phrase, but he's like, I was hanging out with Kanye, and then Kanye got a call. Who was it? Somebody called him. Who was it?
So it was Kanye was backstage with Dave Chappelle and Jay-Z, and Kanye was just coming up, and he was playing a Jay-Z song, and Kanye's verse comes up, and Kanye's like the noob in the room, and he goes, wait, stop that track, rewind that and listen to that guy. And he like made him rewind, and then he's like, they're like, dude, what are you doing, man? You're not the big shot here. And then he gets a phone call, and he goes, oh, hello? Yeah, that's fine, but can I call you back? Yeah, well, I'm backstage watching Never Seen Before clips with Dave Chappelle. Yeah. Because my life's dope and I do dope shit, and then hangs up. And then that's
yeah, exactly. I love that story. That is the best. And also, that philosophy is actually kind of amazing. First of all, to believe in your own life being dope. Like, how many people think that their life is dope, that they are dope and they do dope shit, and therefore they have a dope life? Like, most people don't give themselves that credit. And, you know, they're kind of waiting for dope stuff to happen for them to be able to say that. Kanye's the opposite, right? He's crazy in a bunch of ways, but one of the good ways he's crazy is that he just declares my life is dope and I do dope shit. And guess what? You'll kind of live up to that reputation if you believe that about yourself, right? Like if you say, you know, I take chances, you know, I'm bold. I take bold risks. Well, guess what? You're going to actually take the next bold risk when the opportunity presents itself, because you've kind of hardwired yourself to have that identity. When we were, Sam, you'll like this, at Bebo, when we hired this guy, Jason Hitchcock, and Jason's the best person you can hire because he will believe in you and the cause 150%. Like, he'll believe in you and the mission if you're like his boss and your manager or whatever, like more than you believe in yourself. And he'll believe that the company's going to work even more than the CEO is going to believe. He's like, I call him a Kool-Aid drinker. Like, he drinks the Kool-Aid and he's not ashamed to do it. And so he because of that, he's like an amazing person to have at a startup when there's a lot of people have a bunch of doubt and uncertainty in their mind. And so one day I was talking to Jason and we were like, the HustleCon was coming around the corner. And I was like, I think I'd messaged you. I was like, I want to talk at HustleCon. And I think you were kind of like, yeah, like, I don't know. We got a bunch of speakers already. You kind of blew it off. You're like, you know, and I was like, all right, fair enough. But I asked, and I was like, Jason, next year we're going to talk at HustleCon. I was like, in fact, not just next year, we're going to talk at HustleCon. In fact, everything we do this year, I want you to think about how it's going to play at your HustleCon talk you're going to give. When you're going to give this talk about how we grew from 0 to a million users, how we took over the game in our industry, like, I want you to not just wake up and be like, okay, today I'm going to send out a bunch of emails. It's like, I want you to think about how this could be part of your talk, like how I landed the big fish through cold emails, or how I, you know, growth hacked my way to do X. And we used to talk about that literally on a weekly basis, like, this is part of the HustleCon talk. And it was just to hype ourselves up to like do the more dope version of the task we were already going to do. Because like, imagine you're going to talk about this on stage. That means it must have turned out pretty dope, or you must have done a pretty dope attempt in order to have that mindset. And I still carry that to this day of like, that's a pretty cool way to work.
Here's the quote, by the way. So this is from Kanye. He said, for me, dopeness is what I like most. People who want to make things as dope as possible, and by default, make money from it. The thing that I like least are people who want to make money from things, whether they're dope or not, especially make money from making things the least dope as possible. And I read that quote and I was like, yeah,
we need to make that the intro of the podcast. Ben, find a clip of Kanye saying that out loud and let's make that the opening clip of the podcast. The other thing we did, by the way, that's in this bucket that I highly recommend people do is it's tempting to say we should do cool shit. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. And then like fast forward a month, everybody's feeling tight about the budget or the deadlines or the goal numbers are not being hit or whatever. What's the first thing you cut is the stuff that doesn't easily map to this quarter's result. And so we created a separate do cool shit budget. It was 15% of our total budget we put into a do cool shit bucket, which the outcome of it had to be.
Where?
At Bebo. And then I tried to do this also at Twitch.
Where?
Which was like, hey, whatever the number is that we have to spend, 15% is going to be on cool shit that we cannot like, it doesn't have a measurable immediate payoff. So that's like the criteria. It can't be used in this budget.
Like making a flamethrower.
Like making a flamethrower, or like, you know, I don't know if you saw this. We did the Milk Red rebrand or whatever. And I paid this guy to make this little video that's like this mock Apple commercial. And like, it doesn't do anything. It's not going to drive subscribers. It's not going to like make revenue. In many ways, it is arguably a waste of time and money to just like pay the guy to do that and to even think about the concept and all that. But I've always had this with my companies, which is like, I need 15%. I was like, at the very least, this is just to keep myself amused and engaged and like a fan of my own business. And because I know if I'm like if I'm just more engaged in my own business, I'm going to do that part will pay off. And on the other side, it's like, I think your consumers, the customers of your business also pay attention to that. If they see you doing dope shit just for the sake of doing dope shit, they kind of see you as the cool kid in school in a way, right? Like if you're always just begging for customers or users or doing a discounted sale or like saying, please, please, please follow me. Please, please, please subscribe. Like you kind of are low status in a way. And I think at The Hustle, you guys did a good job of this too. Do you have any examples of this?
Yeah, like we did stuff early on that we kind of like people got mad at. And I was like, they're like, you're going to lose money, lose customers. I'm like, yeah, but it's hilarious. Like one time, we wrote an entire email in Trump's voice, and so we're like, imagine like if you read it and you were saying it out loud, like that it would sound like email. You were Donald Trump.
Everybody loved it. Everybody's saying it's the best. People are saying that. They're saying it's the best.
Yeah, like that's how it was written. And then another time, this was like pretty vulgar, but it was pretty funny. We wrote the subject was, here's the only tip that you need to know for how to be productive today at work. And you open it up and it was just that picture of Johnny Cash where he flicks off the camera and it just says, close this browser and get back to work. And that, and like, that was it. That was the email. And we sent that to 120,000 people. We didn't even send an email. And then maybe one final thing, this woman, Lindsay, worked for me and she sent the Tuesday's email on Wednesday, which is like a mistake. And she's like, shit, she's freaking out. And I was like, here, do this. I wrote in Slack. I was like, hey, you know, I heard you sent the wrong email. And she replied in Slack. Yeah, my bad. It was really messed up. I go, we got to talk. But until then, just like fix it. And she replied with like, well, what should I do? I was like, I don't know, man. Just put the new email in and send it again. And just take a screenshot of this and like put that in, and they'll understand, I'm sure. And he goes, and she replied with something like funny. And that was just the screenshot that just went at the top of the email. There was no explainer.
Right.
And so we would do like little things like that all the time. What about you, Michael? Yeah. Are there any companies that you look at that kind of fall into this category?
It's super fun. Well, I did find one to talk about. Have you guys done PopSockets before?
You talked to that?
We haven't talked about it, no.
Yeah, it's a crazy story. So it's the little, like, you take the back of the case of your phone and you put the little ring on it. Well, that's patented. And they're called PopSockets. And they're very litigious. So the business started in 2014 and they sold 30,000 of these things. So they're, you know, 10 or 12 bucks, whatever. But then they got really popular and the Chinese started trying to knock them off and sell them on Amazon and all this stuff. And so it was a UC Boulder professor. And by 2017, they sold 35 million of them. In 2018, they sold 60 million of these things. So all because they have a patent on this little way that, you know, teenage young girls in Orange County want to grip their phone, like they're just printing money. So supposedly in 2018, they had 200 million in revenue and 90 million in profit, all because of a patent. It's one of the greatest. Yes, I know this is true because I got it off of Wikipedia. When I researched this a few months ago.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Got to be several hundred million, at least. I mean, they got to keep growing. Every lady I know has one of those things. You fit your nails in there. It's great.
Sam, you want to know a little realization I had today? When Michael was coming on, I was like, all right, what do I know about Michael? I was like, he does that like Chili's little shtick where he's always like, you know, the only thing, I don't know how I would explain it, but you basically just like find an excuse to name drop Chili's and say how great Chili's is and like why it's the best place for a meeting. And like, you're just like, you know, oh my God, you know, so happy for, you know, Mother's Day. I love my mother, but not as much as I love Chili's, right? Like you just like come up with some way to like integrate Chili's in. And Sam, I don't know if you've seen this, but I actually, me and Ben talked about this once. We go, when we were like trying to build up my brand, it was like, all right, I got this podcast, it's brand new. I got a Twitter, it was like, you know, a few thousand followers at the time. And it was like, what should we do to like build a brand? So we did this one, like, you know, 2-hour exercise. We just looked at people who had good brands. And we're like, what's some common things that they do? And one of the things we found was that a lot of people have early on in the tech industry, that's like in the 70s or some shit, but like early on when I got into tech, I was following some people on Twitter and I saw this guy, Ryan Hoover, and he seemed interesting. He was blogging. He started this thing called Product Hunt, but Ryan it was always Phil's Coffee and LaCroix. Like he would always talk about Phil's Coffee and LaCroix. And in fact, like LaCroix kind of became like a startup meme. I really give Ryan a lot of credit for it because he was always effing talking about LaCroix. And then when Product Hunt got popular, it just like accelerated the LaCroix meme in the community as like, you know, what's like low key great? LaCroix. And like, and so he had LaCroix and then I don't know. So Pomp does this thing with Domino's all the time where he's like, he'll do like a Domino's pizza. He always says that like Domino's is the best, I think. And he's just like, and it's kind of this thing where you get this serious business persona in one way, but then you show this like human side and it's like, oh, I'm just like, I love this thing. You know, I don't know if yours would be like Topo Chico or something like that. Like you used to like kind of pip those out. Michael's got Chili's.
We got to make ours Cheesecake Factory.
Yeah. Like I was like Chick-fil-A, Cheesecake Factory. We need something that's like our shtick. That's like, it can't just be false. Like you got to genuinely have that love for it. The only part that's the shtick is that you talk about it and you don't really talk about, it's like you're serious, serious, serious. Topo Chico, because it's like, you know, this makes the cut. It's that important to me. It's that good. It is. I'm that big of a fan.
You're like, Michael, we had a great time. You know, let me know when you're in Austin. We'll go out sometime for some Cheesecake Factory and maybe get the chicken piccata. We'll have a great time.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That sounds good. Is that on menu like page 14 of the menu or 57?
Yeah, it's on the Skinnylicious menu.
So I think when you pick this thing, the thing I would recommend, it's got to be something that's, well, okay, so here's a story for you. So I'm 25 years old and I'm finally figuring out how to talk to women in my life. Like, it's just like, I had not figured it out at this point. And so my buddy and I decided to start going to parties and we would dress up in suits. And this is like when everybody's like dressed in like grunge, like in San Francisco, like, so it didn't work. So we'd show up dressed in these fancy suits. And it was just odd enough that the women would be like, why are you guys doing this? Like, it's just slightly odd, right? And so I think you need to figure...
Peacocking.
What's it called? Peacocking? Yeah, okay. I could have been one of those, like, with the pickup artist guys. Exactly. Who needs to do this Holdco stuff? I could be a pickup artist. I could not do that. Anyway, I don't like hair gel enough. But anyway, the... I think you got to figure out something that's just a little bit odd. You're like, why does this like technology entrepreneur in San Antonio like Chili's so much? So if the Cheesecake Factory is that, I think you're good. But whatever it is, it's got to be just a little like that. They're like, why are they wearing suits to this party? Yeah. Like, what's going on?
It can't be cool.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. It can't be cool. Because if you're just trying to say some fad that like everybody thinks is cool, then now you're just hopping on a bandwagon. Yeah. You have to say something that's actually not so cool. Like for me, like the genuine one would be Cinnabon. Like I fucking love Cinnabon. Nobody even thinks about Cinnabon. So that's the corner for Cinnabon is open. I can take that corner. You know, that's a piece of land on the board that nobody's touching right now. I could just pick that up for cheap. But people do know it. It's kind of nostalgic and it gives people something to like, something that they can gift you. Some place they can offer to take you, some place that every time they go there or see one, they will think of you. Like every time I drive by a Chili's, God damn it, I think of Michael Girdley, right? And it's like, same thing with LaCroix and Ryan Hoover. It's like, they own that mental real estate in my mind. And so, Sam, we could do that with Cheesecake Factory. We could just, every time someone sees it, they see us.
You definitely should do that. That's a great idea.
All right. Thanks for coming on, man.
Wait. He's got a problem promoting himself. What's his handle?
At Girdley on Twitter.
Sick. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming on. That was awesome.